We'll bring the meeting to order. And we have a quorum, and so we'll first deal with our minutes of February 15th. Representative Junkie, if you...
I read them over, Mr. Chair. My name is spelled correctly. I move approval.
Okay. Representative Junkie moves to approve the minutes of February 15th. Any additions or corrections? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. Minutes are approved. We will continue where we left off yesterday. And Commissioner, for the tape, if you re-identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kristen Applegate. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And with me again today is David Menke, who's the Deputy Director at the Office of Environmental Assistance. We will begin resume our biennial budget presentation where we left off yesterday, which is a discussion related to a proposal for a reduction in our general fund appropriations and a related, and that would be affecting our water quality programs specifically and as well as administrative support programs, and a related request to reallocate $11.7 million from our remediation programs to those water quality programs. Just for your information, this change item is found on pages 10 and 11 in the Pollution Control Agency portion of your budget. But if I could suggest, we do also have a handout available to you that is entitled This Change Item, General Fund Reduction / Environmental Fund Reallocation Change Item. It looks like this. It's a two-sided question and answer type fact sheet. And I think that for ease of presentation, it would probably be easiest to work from this because there were a number of questions that came up in the initial phases of our presentation of this information, and I'm hoping that this addresses most of those questions. So we began yesterday by talking about the specific general fund reduction, which was $2.95 million per year. Specifically, 2.55 of that affected our water quality program. In this change item, we're also requesting a reallocation of $11.7 million of funding from our remediation programs to our water quality programs. So the first thing that we need to explain is what is the differential associated with a $2.55 million general fund reduction and a reallocation of funds that are greater than that. We began this discussion yesterday, and so the first question and answer relates to specifically that. What we have in terms of a gap in water quality funding that we are asking to reallocate funds and restore is the general fund reduction that we're proposing this biennium, a $5.8 million historic water quality funding gap, which I will explain, and we have some questions and answers that do explain on this sheet, and then a $3.35 million of increased costs associated with running the program. This is largely related to health care costs and is, something that most programs are facing. Specifically related to the $5.8 million historic gap, what is that? The best way I think I can describe this is a historic structural imbalance in the amount of work that we agree needs to be accomplished in order to achieve our water quality goals through the legislative discussions at the agency and elsewhere, the appropriations associated with that amount of work that needs to be accomplished, and then the funding that's available to do that work. They don't match and haven't for about the past decade. So what this began, I think, in terms of discussions back in 1996, so around that time frame with the Blue Ribbon Task Force, which at that point was looking at an imbalance in terms of fee funds available to pay for just the point source program. But this really is important to note that this relates to the overall water quality program, not just the point sources. I'm going to spend more time talking about what the specifics are related to the remediation program reductions or delays that we're asking to make for the next 2 years. But in general, what we're talking about is, or proposing, is a $5.1 million delay in cleanup at lower priority Superfund sites and closed landfill cleanup sites, where we would delay some work at each of those sites. Again, that's five sites from a Superfund standpoint and 14 closed landfill sites. We would also propose a $6.6 million annual reallocation from the closed landfill program funding reserves, and I'll explain that further as well. It's important to note that what we're proposing is this reallocation to fund our water quality work for a two-year period of time. So while we think the remediation work that we're proposing to delay is not urgent for the next 2 years, it is important to do that work for the maintenance of those facilities over the long term. And so we do think it's important to continue that during the next biennium. That means that during the next biennium, we'll be here discussing with you again some proposed solution to address this water quality funding gap, hopefully a long-term or a permanent solution to it. It would have to take into account some combination of increased fees, reductions in work that we do in our water quality program, and or new funding sources. And so that will be a discussion that we'll need to have next legislative session. What we're proposing is our best solution for this biennium. The importance, we think, of funding this water quality work is that this is activities related to point source permitting in our water quality program, and why that is important to us is that it's 1,400 facilities that we issue discharge permits to. This is our means for getting on-the-ground improvements in water quality from a point source perspective, whether that be through effluent limits, new standards, or pollution prevention opportunities. Those permits are how we achieve water quality results in point sources. Also, this relates to our septic system work, our work with counties, our ongoing work to continue our rules and enforcement associated with that work. And why this is important is that as we've looked at impairments, water quality impairments across Minnesota, or water qualities that don't meet, or waters that don't meet water quality standards, we're finding that fecal coliform is an issue, and in areas where fecal coliform is an issue, that septic systems play an important role there. So we think that's important work to continue. We've made significant progress related to feedlots since the implementation of the new feedlot rules several years ago. We don't want to lose that progress. Also, this funding provides maintenance of our level of effort related to monitoring. Currently, we only have 14% of our lakes assessed, 8% of our streams assessed, and we have a goal of achieving a much higher rate of assessment related to the condition of our water quality. This funding also pays for total maximum daily load studies, which are critical to our ability to address both the environmental and economic development ramifications of impaired waters. And so we know we need to continue and to complete these total maximum daily load studies. We currently have 105 either initiated or in some phase of work or completion, but we have 1,890 water quality impairments out there, so we have a lot of work in this program to be done. Also, this pays for, or this funds, Clean Water Partnership pass-through funding, which is a competitive grant program to local governments or other entities to complete on-the-ground water quality restoration. And I actually have some very good statistics about water quality improvements associated with those projects that I have but won't spend the time to talk about in detail right now. So what we found is that this is important work, not just to the agency, but to the citizens of Minnesota, to legislative bodies over time, to governors over time. And so, again, work is authorized to continue in these areas. Appropriations are made, but we just simply don't have funding sources or the funding available to match up with that. So what have we done in the past? Well, it's been a number of creative solutions that have been come up with largely for two-year periods of time or for each biennium as we go through. I can just go through some of the things in recent history. In the 2000 session, this gap the historic gap, that is, was funded through fund transfers from the balance in the solid waste fund. That solid waste fund is now a part of the environmental fund, but at the time was separate. In 2001, for the next fiscal year's budget, the next biennial budget, the legislature approved transfers or reallocations from a number of funding sources, including the Solid Waste Fund, Hazardous Waste Fee Account, and the ISTS Fee Account. In that 2002 session, there was a fee increase granted of $683,000, but that was granted in order to offset a general fund reduction in that equal amount that took place that session, so it was a revenue-neutral fee increase. Last biennium, we were here and we discussed a proposal for a fee increase for our water quality permit applications, which are paid once every 5 years, which would have raised $3 million a year. But the actual fee increase that resulted from the session was a $400,000 fee increase. And instead, other funds were utilized to be able to fund that work, including the funds from the Environmental Fund, which was a result of our fund consolidation work and remediation funds, as well as we had an influx of one-time federal funds that we used to help fill that gap. So while a number and most of these have been biennial budget solutions or two-year windows that we've come up with various solutions at the time, last session had the most promise for a long-term funding solution, which was the environmental fund consolidation proposal that you approved. In that, we were the view was that as our remediation and cleanup programs begin to ramp down to a maintenance level over time, there would be additional funds available in the environmental fund that the legislature could choose, certainly wouldn't have to choose, but could choose to use for this purpose, for this water quality work. However, because of the financial times that we've been in for the past number of years, those fund balances no longer exist in order to be able to have that available for your use and this purpose. Last couple of items on this. We received a specific question yesterday after the meeting asking if this reallocation of funds from the remediation programs would replace a loss of federal funds. And though we are losing some federal funds related to water quality activities in this next biennial budget, those are pass-through funds, and we are not proposing through this to actually fill those gaps whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, as I mentioned, what we've done is in the past use federal funds to fill our one-time federal funds to try to fill the gap as a part of the larger solution in a two-year period of time versus the other here where we'd be proposing to fill a federal reduction. Last thing that's important to note about this change item is that also a part of the general fund reduction that we're proposing for this year is a $400,000 permanent reduction in our administrative support activities. We're not proposing through this reallocation to reallocate any funds to those areas, but this would instead be a permanent reduction where we've taken a number of other reductions a number of other reductions in the past few years. So with that, I can pause here, or I can move on to the specific remediation program information.
I have a question. If you could maybe give us a better idea of what filling the gap means in the form of FTEs. I mean, are you adding personnel? Are you moving them around? What is actually happening with regard to personnel and the costs associated with them?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Important point that I neglected to make, which is that this is a proposal to maintain our current program. So we're not talking about any new FTEs associated with this work. What you will see if you look at your budget pages is you will see an increase in FTEs associated with the water program. You'll also see a corresponding decrease, actually a greater decrease, associated with our remediation program work. And essentially, this is just, as you look at last year's or last biennium solution. Part of what we did is pay for some, through our fund consolidation, had the opportunity to pay for some water work in other program areas. In other words, we paid for hydrologists in some of our land activities who actually were doing water work. We thought it would be appropriate to be more clear and transparent about the best place to have that work funded this year. So it is not about new work happening in the water quality program or new FTEs doing that work, simply about how we're showing it in the budget this year.
Okay. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Applegate. Some folks have come to me and suggested that regarding contaminated soil, like when a tank is removed, an underground storage tank or some source of contaminated soil, that the agency is asking or requiring or allowing for that soil to be stored in a lined landfill rather than using a treatment facility to clean that soil and then to put it, for example, in the closed landfill program to cover additional cover for places in the area. I see there's a few that we're delaying here. And I'm wondering why we would store it in a landfill forever, seemingly forever, rather than treating it and putting it back out where it can be of some use and not filling up landfills. And the place that I'm thinking of is up in Duluth. In the Duluth area, there's a waste management site up at I think it's either Canyon or Cotton, and there's some contaminated, a lot of contaminated soil being hauled there, rather than to a nearby treatment facility that has, you know, technology that does that kind of work.
Right, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, I think I'm familiar with the specifics that you're talking about. I'll give you a general answer, and if you'd like more, I can certainly ask for some additional assistance. Essentially, what has occurred, and again, I think I'm familiar with the specific site you're talking about, is that in areas where we know we're going to need that type of material, or we're going to need material for cover anyway, this is one use or one opportunity, one material that could be used as a part of that cover. There are, in some instances, as a part of our treatment and cleanup associated with those soils, natural attenuation would take place, and so whether that be in the form of a landfill cover or the material we would use for landfill cover or elsewhere, both are effective means of dealing with it. And so that's it's something that we've allowed for that purpose.
Let's follow up, Chairman. And Commissioner Applegate, then, is that happening across the state or is that just something that's happening up in the Northeast? Practice.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill, that's something that I can't tell you the specifics of, and I can certainly get that information to you if it's one facility or a number.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions at this point?
Yes.
So, again,
thank you. This putting off contaminated sites because they're lower priority. It's extraordinarily troubling to me because the contamination is all groundwater contamination from toxics. And so it's hard for me to jump from saying this water issue is less important than the other water issue. And I look at the closed landfill program, and I know that a lot of what we can do in there is bonding. And I don't understand why you didn't just ask for additional bonding dollars to cover the gap instead of just putting it off. That you could have. It looks to me like you could have done much of what you want with bonding dollars.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Aquinas, if I could suggest that maybe we go to the other handout that we provided, which is related to the closed landfill cleanup program, this might be a good time to walk through that information as a part of response to Representative Aquinas' question.
Which page?
It looks like this. It's called the Closed Landfill Cleanup Program Proposed Delays Due to Budget Reductions in FY06 and 07.
Okay.
Yep, that's the one. Thank you. Representative Aguinius, or Mr. Chairman, Representative Aguinius, essentially what we're talking about delaying is work at sites that were not even scheduled at this point, but were potential. Was potential work at sites. What we are talking about is enhancements in some cases. We are proceeding with bonding requests, as well as ongoing work from our base funding for priority sites that we think actually pose more of an environmental or have some particular human health risk. What I can tell you about these sites that is that of the 14 we're talking about, significant work has already been completed at 8 of them. Most of them are remote locations. The ones that aren't are where we've seen the most work already completed. Again, this relates to more maintenance activity, and so it's things that we know that we would want to do over time for the integrity of the facility, but is not urgent to complete at this time. This is not related to any sort of specific human health or environmental threat. And so that's why we proposed to delay these specific sites. We are proposing through the bonding bill this year, which you I know had some discussion around, and the discussion continues, as well as future bonding bills, as well as through our base budget program, to continue work on a number of sites that we think are critical in terms of those environmental risks. With these, what we're saying is that, again, from the standpoint of the maintenance of those facilities over time, we need to complete this work, which is why we're only requesting a two-year delay. But in terms of a specific urgency about completing the work now, we don't see that.
Nonetheless, you're talking about a delay. You're the ones that brought up the delay. And it seems to me there are a couple of ways we could have addressed it rather than delaying it and procrastinating and have other people pay for it. We could have asked for more bonding. I mean, am I just wrong about that? I see slope repair, new cover, land acquisition, new cover. Those are bondable projects. And so so we could work on those projects if we intended to work on them, it seems to me. The second thing is, we get a huge amount of money now from that we didn't anticipate when we did the closed landfill bill from insurance proceeds. And what is that money going into the general fund, or is that money being spent on these sites? And maybe you need to tell the committee how much money that involves.
All right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Agenius, I'll address the first part of your question, and then I'm going to ask for some assistance with the specifics of the amount we have from insurance recovery. You're right. There are, of course, always options about how you would proceed related to a decision like this. What we're telling you is this is the best solution that we would propose for addressing environmental priorities over the next 2 years. There is work proposed in terms of bonding. We have actually other sites we think more critical than these that we would also propose for future bonding bills. This is not among that high priority work. And then, is it Jim or? And Mr. Chairman, if it's all right, I'm going to ask Jim Warner to respond to the question related to the investment fund. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jim Warner. I'm the director of the Industrial Division at the Pollution Control Agency. Prior to that, it was the Majors and Remediation Division Director, which had oversight of the remediation programs, including the insurance recovery. Part of the closed landfill program. The insurance recovery program has had a tremendous success. It's done through an agreement with an outside law firm through the Attorney General's office, and that program, as of this past week on most recent settlement, will have reached $100 million in settlements from insurance companies. That money goes into it actually went a couple different places. It first went into a landfill closed landfill investment fund, which was set aside for a period of 20 years before it could be utilized for long-term care of these facilities. Because once each of the sites is completed in its activities, we as the state maintain that facility on out into perpetuity. And so the purpose of setting the money aside was for long-term purposes of maintenance and management of those facilities, along with the dollars that would come in through the generation of the solid waste tax. The insurance recovery dollars went in and funded that that amount of money. Once that was reached, it's I think it was $20 million. Then the remainder of that goes back into the remediation fund for use in the closed landfill program.
Representative McKinney.
So all of that money, none of that money has gone into the general fund. It's all been used for closed landfills.
I can't speak to whether it has gone to the general fund, unless it was pulled out. If any money moved from the remediation fund into the environmental, into the general fund, once it got into the remediation fund, I don't know if it's targeted as it could dollars. Somebody from the finance group is going to have to help me on that part.
Mr. Chairman, here's my concern. When we passed the closed landfill bill, we were not counting on this $100 million. We funded it, not counting on a dime from that, because we weren't sure that part would work. So the fact that we have $100 million more than we anticipated should mean that we could complete our job in the closed landfill program without having to procrastinate or shortcut. Something feels amiss to me, and I can't quite put my finger on it, why we should be procrastinating or not doing an absolutely outstanding job or putting the money into the reserve, which is a truly good idea because we will have to maintain these things forever. So I don't know where this extra $80 million has gone. I mean, I understand the $20 million, and that's a good deal, but I don't understand where the extra $80
million went. Mr. Chair, Representative McGinnis, it went into the remediation fund. Let me also clarify, just for purposes of understanding where the money also went. The outside attorney that manages the lawsuits and the negotiations with the insurance industry does take a percentage of that dollar amount for their costs associated with that agreement with the Attorney General's office.
Well, what is the amount that Minnesota has received then from the from the insurance proceeds?
Mr. Chairman, I hope Representative Guinness, my name is Rod Massey from the Police Control Agency. I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but I believe the attorney takes 30% or 33% off the top, so that leaves about $60 and $70 million that came through. And what we have done, as I understand it, and I'm new to this job, but this is my recollection, is that half the money has gone into the investment fund, which is for long-term care. It's invested in instruments so that it can be cashed out in 2020. The other half went into the remediation fund, environmental fund, and that was part of the fund balances that were available in the last biennial budget. And so when because of the conditions that we had in the state, the fund balances were taken. Some of that was insurance money, some of it was the MLCAT fund, some of it was solid waste tax dollars. So that's where the money went. We don't have it tucked in our pockets. The investment fund is set aside for future liabilities and taking care of long-term perpetuity care of those landfills. That actually is about $30 million.
Okay, well, listening to you, we should be showing probably about $35 million, between $30 and $35 million in that investment fund. And that's what we're showing? Okay, I'm getting the signal that is, yes, the case.
It will be there. Jim just cited the most recent settlement. That wasn't part of this budget proposal. So that's what made it to go up to $100 million. So it will be, when that settlement's included, we'll again split it, and we'll have between $30 and $35 million in investment funds. And it will create, I don't know what the last settlement is, that will create some balance in the remediation fund. And so that may allow us to do some work.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay. Nonetheless, that leaves $35 million that was designated for the landfill program that we weren't counting on. We weren't counting on it. To put off when we have this obligation and we made huge commitments as a state to take over and make sure that there was no groundwater leakage. This was all done for groundwater reasons. So that will bring me to my next question, and this is the one that is most important to me. You all carry a figure of how much leachate has been contained through the program. What is that figure now, and what will that figure be if we adopt your 2-year procrastination?
Mr. Chair, right now it's slightly or right around 80% of the leachate that is collected or reduced from when we originally started. But when you look at the facilities, we're talking about delaying 2 years. We're only talking 3% of the total amount of leachate that's generated at all the facilities across the state.
Then, Mr. Chairman, if I...
One person's procrastination may be another person's prioritization. I appreciate the prioritizing of the department. Representative Wagenius.
I am worried about the other 20% of the leachate and where it's going, because that's what all this money was designated for, so we are 20% short of where we need to be in terms of the landfill program right now.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for one of the witnesses. I'm just wondering, I assume there are other landfills to be closed that are not on this list. What is the total number of landfills remaining to be closed?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have 112 landfills in the state, and I think we have what was indicated in the bonding site. I think it was 17 projects yet to go there, and it's probably a neighborhood around 20 that need to do the major work yet to be done. We have a few that haven't been brought into the system, about 4, and one of those is a major facility yet to be dealt with. The other rest of them are pretty small, old, isolated sites that you need to get to.
Thank you. Okay. I continue.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unless there are additional questions still on this change item, which we'd be happy to entertain, we could move on to... Oh, looks like there is.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question on the Superfund program and the 5 sites that are being put off as far as work being done. One of them is called Valentine Clark in St. Paul, and it's contaminated with PCBs and dioxins. Do you understand that you could have bonded for that project if you wanted to, but chose not to? Or how does that work? Could you just clarify that for me?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, since bonding is available only for publicly owned sites, I don't believe that would have been eligible. And just a clarification as it relates to the Superfund sites, what we're talking about related to those is actually, again, some limited work, investigation, some limited cleanup to address the most concerning risks associated with any of these sites, although I'll point out that these are among our very lowest scoring sites in terms of risk. And then what we would delay is the completion of cleanup associated with these sites.
Just a brief follow-up. Could you have the project manager for that particular project give me a call? We're talking about it, or her.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Can you?
All right, Mr. Chairman, members, we'll move on to then the last change item that we have before you related to our biennial budget proposal. It's found on pages 12 and 13 of your of the PCA portion of your budget materials. And by contrast to the water discussion that we just had, the air program is primarily funded through air emission fees. Actually, by about 90% of the program is funded through air emission fees. 10% comes from federal funding sources. We didn't ask for a fee increase related to this programmatic activity last biennium, and worked instead to try to achieve results within our existing resources. We did find that we began to fall behind related in particular to some of our permitting activities, our Title V federal permitting activities. The federal government requires us to collect sufficient fees as a part of this program to maintain an adequate program. And while they don't require us to raise fees, they do require that we can demonstrate that we have an adequate program that includes permitting compliance, ambient monitoring, that is, regulatory development, emissions inventories, and providing information to the public related to those activities. So based on this previous biennium's experience in terms of the Title V work, we didn't feel that we could actually demonstrate that adequacy. So we first looked at some internal strategies related to efficiencies within the program. I mentioned yesterday a process improvement effort that we have in this program as well related to our construction permits. We've also developed a couple of other permitting strategies or permitting options that would actually, we hope, result in both environmental improvement and a reduced workload. And we've determined that those will help in terms of resources and potentially reducing a request. It didn't negate the need for additional resources for this program. So as a result, we're requesting your authorization to increase air emission fees by $532,000 in FY06 and $839,000 in FY07 over a base of approximately $11 million, which represents an increase of approximately 7% over the biennium. This increased appropriation would cover the increasing cost of maintaining the current program. Again, this is not about new FTEs or activities, but is what we would need in order to maintain our current level of effort. A significant percentage, just by note, of air emission fees are paid by the top 10 or so sources of emissions. It's a per-ton emission fee that's paid. We have communicated with folks who are the largest fee payers in this program about our request. And so that you're aware, the sectors that are most impacted include utilities, mining, and refining in terms of the largest air emission sources. This increase would bring us to about the middle of the range regionally and nationally in terms of the fees that are charged. From a regional perspective, Wisconsin charges more and the Dakotas charge less. And so I'm happy to answer any questions you have on that. It's just the basics related to the air fee increase.
Representative Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Applegate, I think that U.S. Steel MINTAC operations is one of the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
can you tell me what their present fee is and what the new fee after the increase would be? And get a feel for that. Although the steel mining industry is doing quite well right now, they're very cyclical, and their costs are really important when the competition gets tough.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, their 2004 fee was $904,000 approximately. This would be in the top three of air emission sources. They would have an increase of about $50,000 based on that 7% over the biennium, bringing them to about $955,000.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, other question, Representative Wiggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the emerging issues for us and in our last air inversion that we all experienced was fine particulate matter. And the cost to Minnesotans of fine particulate matter is extremely high in terms of medical costs. Can you help us out in telling us what you are going to be doing over the next biennium with regard to fine particulate matter and in helping us understand exactly what these costs are? Because here we are struggling with the costs of health care. I mean, both the state and private folks are struggling with it. So how are you going to be able to help us out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, let's see. We'll start with some background context information. We do currently meet all ambient air quality standards. We did have a specific occurrence a couple of weeks ago that most of you heard about, where we did have levels of fine particulate matter in the air that were unhealthy for all populations. That was the first time we've had that type of alert related to all populations. Though we meet all, again, ambient air quality standards, we do have on the average of 10 or 12 or so days a year where the air is unhealthy for specific populations, children, the elderly, people who have specific respiratory conditions, things like that. So what we have been doing to try to address reductions and improvement strategies related to that, again, because we're one of only 11 states that meet the standards on an ongoing basis, we've looked at a number of sort of no-regrets strategies, things that we think are important for us to move forward with, because particularly as it relates to fine particles, we know that there are human health concerns below the standard. We actually have reason to believe that EPA will be pursuing a lowering of that standard over time. So there's a few things that we should mention, and the nice thing about a lot of these strategies is that they benefit both fine particles, in some cases ozone, other things as well. So there's strategies that improve air quality from a number of perspectives. First of all, you are probably familiar with the Metropolitan Emissions Reduction Project. That is either upgrading or changing a fuel source of three of Xcel's facilities in the metropolitan area. That project alone will result in a 95% reduction of nitrous oxides or nitrogen oxides and sulfur oxides, which are precursors to the formation of fine particles or PM2.5. In addition to that, we have a number of activities related to cleaner fuels and technology related to motor vehicles that are coming online from the federal government. And what we're trying to do is early implementation related to that that work, both from a clean fuel standpoint and from a cleaner technology standpoint related to buses in particular. And so by way, again, of background here, in 2006, there is a requirement for ultra-low sulfur diesel to be utilized across the country. And in addition to that, in 2007, there'll be some requirements related to engine technology improvements. And between those two things, we'll see a 95% reduction from diesel emissions related to those vehicles. In Minnesota, we've been working with the Metropolitan Council, who has started to utilize ultra-low sulfur diesel in over half of their fleet of buses, and in addition have been working with a number of school districts to look at retrofitting their school buses and using, again, cleaner fuel technology in order to improve those emissions as well. Further, and this one relates more to ozone, we've been working on stage one vapor recovery at all of our gas stations. That was actually also a legislative initiative that you passed in 2002, requiring by next January that there's stage one vapor recovery at all gas stations. This will result in a 95% reduction in VOCs from the previous emissions. The other things we've been doing are actually trying to get information out to the public and improving our efforts there as it relates to particularly alert days where we're having a specific air quality event. the event a couple of weeks ago was related to not just emissions in Minnesota, of course, but related to a specific and unique weather condition as well as regional transport of pollutants. But during those times, we think it's important to have information available to the public so that they can understand the changes they can make in terms of reducing emissions during those times. And we have 2,000 people that are currently on our air alert network, so we inform them of any specific air alert. And through our work with Clean Air Minnesota, we're actually able to reach 100,000 citizens with that kind of information about specific steps they can take. This is all information that we'll be presenting to you in the form of a legislative report, a status report related to our air quality activities that will be coming soon. I'll just, you know, give a plug for that in the sense that I think it is something that will be really helpful for the committee, something that you may want to discuss in greater detail. And it's a format that we're quite proud of. I think it's exceptionally easy to follow in terms of the specific work that we are doing to make improvements in these areas and future recommendations as well.
Okay. And I'd really prefer to handle those when that time comes up. Right now I'd really like to focus on the budget issues. And is it my understanding on the when you're proposing a 7% increase, it says depending on actual emissions during the year. Does that mean that the fees are actually based upon the volume of emissions?
Right.
And so that the increase will actually be an incentive then for people to reduce their emissions, because if the lower the emissions, the less they pay?
Mr. Chairman, we can hope that that's the case. And yes, they are emissions that are paid on a per ton of pollution basis. And the reason that they are, the language that you referenced is structured that way, is that they're paid based on actual emissions from the previous year.
Okay. Other questions on the budget? Okay, would you continue?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think then we are at our conclusionary comments, which is that, again, we want to stress that our focus related to the Department of Environmental Protection is to provide a greater range of tools and better solutions as it relates to the complex environmental problems that are facing us today. Greater transparency, not just as it relates to funding and expenditures in our programs, but also as it relates to performance and results, as well as, again, that drive for outcomes and results. And so that is what we'd like to leave you with in terms of a view of what we've seen with the new department, and happy to answer any other questions that you might have.
Yesterday I had a chance to briefly look at your website and go to the specific goals that you have established in each of the different categories, as well as the information that talks about the outcomes that you have, hopefuls as well as actuals, and I thought that was very good information. I really appreciated that website.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
President Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too went to the website, and I thought maybe I was missing where I was supposed to go, because I didn't see any outcomes with regard to groundwater. I'm not the computer whiz that perhaps Representative Osmus is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, it depends on what you were actually viewing in terms of our reports. We do, on a quarterly basis, as I mentioned before, update progress related to a number of our internal performance measures, as well as progress related to various elements of our strategic plan. And what we tend to do, because we have a fairly robust strategic plan that sets out a lot of environmental goals, is we focus on one environmental media per quarter so that we can really spend the time that we need to demonstrate and to talk about progress made on those goals. And so I'm not certain which quarter was the specific reports related to groundwater, but I could certainly provide that to you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I was looking actually at the governor's budget and the outcomes under the governor's budget categories, and I didn't see any outcomes with regard to groundwater there. I actually didn't look at the Ag Department, and I'll make sure I do that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bouguinas, that would be fine. And certainly, as I said, it is something that is a part of goals related to our strategic plan on groundwater. And so we're happy to provide you with information that we've tracked related to that.
Okay. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is our conclusion slide.
Any additional questions? Okay. Representative Guinness.
Mr. Chairman, I know you don't want to talk about air quality right now, but because we are dealing, you know, sometimes when you sit on other committees, you see the problems here seen from a different perspective. And I'm glad you understand that fine particulate matter below does have health impacts below the standards we have. But the question I'm trying to get at is what are our actual health care costs? We documented them in MERP. You documented them in MERP. What we need to have an understanding about is what they are in the metropolitan area. So we know whether this is where we should put a lot of effort or a little bit of effort, but there are clearly huge costs involved with fine particulate matter, and it's hard to get a handle on them if you all don't have that information. So I'm just hoping it's in your air quality report, I guess that's what I'm saying, that we see that the health care costs in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'd now like to have some public testimony. And we have some individuals that have indicated that they would like to speak to us with regard to the MPCA's budget proposal. And Paul Gardner, Recycling Association of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Gardner, Executive Director for the Recycling Association of Minnesota. We're not a trade association, but we are a 501c3 nonprofit located in St. Paul. And we have 220 members from the public, private, and nonprofit sectors who deal in recycling, and it includes most of the people who either let you know about how to recycle and deal with your waste materials, pick it up, sort it, ship it, or make it into a new product. We just had some very brief comments. We do not have a position on the merger per se, but we do want to leave you with a couple of main points on the score stabilization proposal. First, we just wanted to reiterate that SCORE funding has been the critical mechanism for comprehensive recycling service from one end of the state to the other, from Roseau to Blue Earth to Kindy, Ohio, to every place in the metro. And we actually have a higher recycling rate in our rural areas of the state than many other states do, and I would argue we do it better there than anywhere else in the country. Second, and more importantly, American manufacturers right now, including those in Minnesota, can't get enough recycled materials right now. I'll elaborate more on that, and SCORE helps to alleviate that tight supply problem that we have right now. Third, the proposed SCORE stabilization proposal should, as it's laid out on paper, reduce the risk to SCORE funding the counties to avoid having money taken from the general fund that otherwise would go to SCORE. So we seem to be okay with that proposal, although we obviously would have a concern in future years that some of that money from the environmental fund that would go to recycling might go somewhere else. And finally, another important point we want to leave you with is that since this proposal has to be revenue neutral, there won't be any change in the amount of solid waste tax revenue that still goes to and stays in the general fund. That's another issue for another day, but we just wanted to get that on the table. As you may know, SCORE funding, which is matched several times over by counties in Minnesota, has been one of the most wildly successful programs for recycling in the United States, and I always enjoy going to other states for meetings and conferences, and my colleagues are always in awe of Minnesota. It's nice to be a citizen of the state when I go out of state. But that support for SCORE right now is vitally needed because we have an unusual situation, unlike what you may have been led to believe in the early 90s, the late 80s. We actually have really tight supplies of recycled materials right now. We have paper mills, steel mills, Representative Bill referred to, the steel industry, all very competitive right now globally. And the Asian economies, particularly China, is gobbling up a lot of our raw material. I'm not complaining necessarily, but I'm just pointing out that the global marketplace has created a very tight supply, particularly for paper, plastic, and steel. And there are people hauling out old cars and tractors out of their barns to take it to the scrap yard to sell it for scrap, which is causing some stress with antique dealers who would like to get their hands on that material. But prices have been so strong and the market so competitive that we can't get enough. And SCORE funding is one of the primary means for letting citizens and businesses know how to use the infrastructure for recycling that we have today. SCORE has also been at risk in the past from diversion to other activities because most of it has come from the general fund. So we just wanted to point out that the proposal to sort of cut out the loop of solid waste management tax revenue to the general fund and then the SCORE will cut it straight to the environmental fund, and that could be a good thing as long as that money still goes to recycling funding. So we are cautiously optimistic about that proposal. But again, we would be watching in future budget years just to make sure that that sort of stays the same way, and we will do our best to make the case along with our partners in the private sector who need that material that, to show you where those dollars go and how it actually helps the private sector get access to those materials. We also do see some opportunity with this stabilization proposal because if I understand it correctly, from the Department of Finance website, if a sufficient case is made for additional funding for a specific need where you could identify a specific outcome rather than just say we'll provide funding to counties to support certain activities, that there may be additional funding from the environmental fund. So it sounds as if this proposal may give us some flexibility, and it does put some responsibility on us in recycling to continue to make the case for you for why recycling is important and why SCORE is important. And that's all I had to say, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Well, thank you very much. I want to just express that it will be the concern of the committee to try and provide some stabilization to this overall program, and we're hopeful also that the moves that we're, proposal we're seeing will help bring some of that stability to it. Easier to try and manage the fund when the dollars are coming in directly than it is to go to the general fund and try to compete to get money back into the environmental area. So this should be a good move. We hope so anyway. We also have Mr. Ted Tulin. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ted Truline. I'm the director of St. Louis County Solid Waste Department. I'm also the president of the Minnesota Solid Waste Administrators Association. Appreciate this opportunity to provide you with some comments today. Like Mr. Gardner, I'm here to urge continued support for Minnesota's SCORE reduction and recycling programs. I'm also hoping that in the future we can look to different ways to increase the funding. When the original SCORE legislation passed back in 1989, it established $15.5 million in SCORE pass-through funding to provide pass-through funds to help local units of government. That funding is now down to $12.5 million. From 1989, if we would have taken just a conservative 2% inflation rate and added it to that money, we would have been up over $20 million, and instead we've only gone down At the same time, Minnesota's counties are matching a 2000 state auditor report found that, or the legislative auditor report found that Minnesota's counties are matching SCORE funding at the rate of 180%. Significant additional local revenue is going to provide those excellent recycling programs that Mr. Gardner mentioned and that I believe we have. And we're very proud of our recycling program. However, they're expensive to run, especially on the collection end. And I believe we need help. When the legislation originally passed back in 1989, it was a partnership between state and local units of government. And I believe that the local units of government have fulfilled their end of that partnership by making a good faith effort in going out and developing some of the best programs in the country. We have seen on the state end, while we continue to receive funding, we've seen that funding decrease, and it certainly hasn't kept up with inflation. We have some additional challenges coming down the way, challenges that we could use some of this additional funding for. We will be, I suspect, especially in greater Minnesota and the rural areas, called upon to help develop CRT and electronics collection programs. We're looking to do a better job of recycling demolition waste. We have challenges coming in treated woods. Up in northeastern Minnesota, we're trying to do some things to develop some mattress processing. These are all important landfill abatement tools and important things for the future, but they cost money. So I guess I'm here to thank you for the support you have given us in the past to help us on a reduction and recycling program and to urge your continued support for those programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I wasn't aware that you were working on treated woods. Can you just expand on that just a bit?
Right now, the question is working on treated woods, and right now we're looking at what's going on around the country with respect to changing regulation on treated wood management. And we're looking at the requirement that many of those treated woods, of course, now they have to go into Subtitle D landfills, lined MSW landfills. In St. Louis County, we happen to have one of the only lined Subtitle D landfills in our area. The closest landfill to our landfill in Virginia is in Brainerd, so it's actually 150 miles, so at least in Minnesota. So we end up being a potential home for many of these kinds of materials. So we're expecting that in the future we'll be seeing some changes with regards to treated wood regulation, and we're just trying to do some of our initial groundwork now to see what we might be able to do with them. We don't have much more going than that right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Were you here yesterday, Mr. Trilling?
No, Mr. Chairman, I was not.
Okay. I want you to know that we yesterday during our hearing expressed the appreciation we have for the contributions and the major effort that the counties have been making towards our recycling. We pointed out that the state is only a fraction of what the counties are actually doing. And so I want to continue to that the same expression, let you know we really appreciate what you're doing out there. We'll do what we can to support it. Mr. Doug Carnival.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, representing the National Solid Waste Management Association, Association of Recyclers, Haulers, and Landfillers. Mr. Chair, we are here to indicate that the idea of moving money from the solid waste tax from the general fund to the environmental fund is something we've supported. We've always supported the idea of the solid waste tax being used for solid waste programs. As you recall, the solid waste tax was a creature of the legislature a number of years ago, which combined a number of taxes. Folks spoke about the SCORE tax that was originally passed in 1988. That was basically a sales tax on waste collection to be used specifically for SCORE programs so that we could become the recycling state that we are now. Subsequently, the solid waste generator assessment was put on to be collected by the haulers to provide for funding for the solid waste, the division of the PCA, and that made sense. And then subsequently, the landfill cleanup program was instituted, and through a coalition of business environmental folks, folks from the legislature. We came up with the landfill cleanup program, which, as Representative Bouguinius has mentioned, was essentially an effort to take over those polluted landfills, clean them up, and put a tax on business that was substantial to bond for some of that, and then to use the insurance proceeds that we were able to acquire. That essentially made three different taxes on solid waste, all for particular purposes. Ultimately, in the 90s, there was an effort, and a successful one, to combine all of those fees and taxes into one solid waste tax, and we ended up with a 17% solid waste tax, a substantial tax on the collection of waste for particular programs that were valuable and everyone agreed made sense. Now, at the time that tax was consolidated, and the time the landfill cleanup program was implemented, there was an effort to try and determine what the amount of money that was necessary to get the landfill cleanup program done, and if in fact more money was being collected than was necessary, that tax was supposed to click down, and there was a window to do that. It never did click down. The window passed. It didn't happen. We always expected there'd be enough money in that fund to take care of the landfill cleanup program. In the past session, or two sessions ago, the legislature decided to provide more flexibility in terms of the use of the solid waste tax, and we now have the environmental fund, which is used for a multitude of purposes. Our concern is, as that flexibility becomes greater and greater, less and less of the solid waste tax is being used for solid waste programs, and Representative Bouguinius's concern is our concern. If now the agency is proposing to use some of the money that is collected from the solid waste tax, not even to finish the landfill cleanup program, which was the bulk of what that fund was supposed to be taken care of and being used for what they perceive at the moment as higher priority, we get further and further away from the purposes of the solid waste tax, which was to take care of solid waste programs. Further, it's our concern that in the future, if there's need for additional dollars, it's easy to increase the solid waste tax, which would then be the income stream for many programs that really didn't deal with solid waste. So we just wanted the committee to recognize that, from our perspective, the idea of the solid waste tax had a purpose and a specific direction, and the further we get away from that, the more concerned this organization gets. Happy to take your questions, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wanted to speak to us about the MPCA's budget proposal? Okay. I think next we'll go to report, Pollution Control Agency's report on phosphorus sources to Minnesota watersheds. Representative Gill, you would take over.
Good morning and welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record, and then you can continue, move forward with your presentation. Thank you for coming this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Marvin Hora, H-O-R-A, from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. With me is Mark Tomasek, also from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and we're here today to overview the detailed assessment of phosphorus sources to Minnesota watersheds. First of all, I'd like to begin by thanking you, the Minnesota Legislature, for funding and the leadership you provided us in directing us to conduct this study. What you will see today is an excellent study, and we're very proud of it. I was the technical manager of the project, so I have an overview. I was the overall project manager. Mark is the technical manager, and he's the person that really knows the details. We'd like to begin the presentation, and I'll just turn it over to Mark.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. We have about a 20-minute PowerPoint presentation, so I think we should have time for discussion and conversation afterwards. The way I'll present the study is to give a brief overview of the legislative initiative, what the study was meant to accomplish, who the partners were, the methods that were used to undertake the study, and give an overview of some of the results. Certainly, as you'll see, the results are much greater than I have time or can present here, but I will give you an idea of an overview of the results. So just as a reminder, I think a lot of people in this room were involved in scoping this study and the legislation that put it together. The initial project grew out of an interest and a discussion on dishwashing detergent and an interest in banning that, the phosphorus in dishwashing detergent statewide. As part of that conversation, there was a lot of conflicting testimony and differences of opinions and differences of the amount of phosphorus that dishwashing detergent contributed to wastewater treatment plants and to the surface waters of the state. As a result of that, the legislature tasked the PCA with conducting a study. So what was authorized? Five items were highlighted in the legislation. The first is to look at lowering phosphorus in wastewater. That amount of phosphorus going to wastewater treatment plants. Number two, to look at the effect of phosphorus and source categories on surface waters. That included both point and non-point source, which we'll report on today. Number three is consideration of how best to treat phosphorus at wastewater treatment plants and remove phosphorus before it's discharged from point sources to surface water. That study is due to be completed this March, so in 4 to 6 weeks. And the study is being conducted by the Minnesota Environmental Sciences and Economic Review Board, MESRB. Fourthly, to look at the rules of nutrient cleaning agents. We already have on the books rules that limit the amount of phosphorus in house cleaning products and detergents and laundry detergents and some other specific categories. So it was to review those rules in consideration of dishwashing phosphorus detergent. And finally, report to the legislature on February 1st, 2004. We submitted that February 27th or 28th, so we were a couple weeks late, but if you'll recall, we had 6 months to do this study, so it was really an effort to look at the data that we did and put the amount of information together. Some other highlights of what was authorized, specific quantification of the amount of non-ingested phosphorus entering POTWs, pumped phosphorus entering POTWs, publicly owned treatment works. Those are wastewater treatment plants operated by municipalities for treatment of wastewater. And also, look at reducing the amount of non-ingested phosphorus entering POTWs by 50%. So non-ingested phosphorus being all that phosphorus that doesn't pass through the human digestive tract. So how did we undertake this study? Three project objectives that we defined. with the identification of point sources, we looked at volume considerations and bracketed the wastewater treatment plants into large, medium, and small size facilities. So we broke them out based on flow for three different flow characteristics, and then also by the amount of rate proportioning of household and industrial wastewater going to these POTWs. So three different categories of those, setting up a matrix of 3x3 or 9 different categories of POTWs that we looked at the phosphorus loading to POTWs for. Second objective was to determine the effects of non-ingested phosphorus on receiving water quality. How much of the phosphorus is treated in wastewater treatment plants, and how does that proportion of phosphorus discharge to surface waters from POTWs compare to other sources of phosphorus to our surface waters? And third, to assess this achieving a 50% reduction goal of non-ingested phosphorus entering POTWs. The study, when we looked at it, we looked at the 10 major basins in the state, and we looked at a statewide perspective. So the data that you'll see presented here should be looked at as a basin perspective. If you have a cabin on a lake, you can't simply extrapolate those values to your lake situation. Mm-hmm. Certainly has a different watershed. It may not even have any point sources going to that lake. And the other thing I want to mention is what we're looking at is the phosphorus entering surface waters, not the amount of phosphorus that's monitored any place in a stream, in a lake, or any place in a watershed. These are loadings to all of our surface waters, both lakes, streams, and wetlands, all inclusive. To do this study, we contracted with Barr Engineering. We set out an RFP and had four consulting firms interested in the project, selected Barr Engineering. They in turn subcontracted with Dr. David Mullah from the University of Minnesota to look at the agricultural loading portion. Also with LimnoTech, a nationally recognized firm, looking at bioavailable phosphorus. So not only were we looking at total phosphorus loading to surface water, but also that portion of phosphorus that's more readily taken up by algae and plants of the phosphorus, so that portion that's bioavailable. We had some 50 MPCA staff working on the project at different times, reviewing technical memorandums and information in their areas of expertise, as well as we worked with staff from many other state and regional agencies. Department of Health, Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Met Council, most notably. So let's go to some results. If we look at point sources, and we're looking now at point sources, the amount of phosphorus that's entering POTWs, so that phosphorus that's in the influent waste stream. And we're looking at a statewide perspective here. Human waste makes up the largest portion on a statewide perspective of the phosphorus entering POTWs, 43%. Next biggest slice of the pie is industrial process wastewater, 27%. A bit surprising to us was the large amount from food soils, 16%. And there you can see the other categories listed there. Toothpaste includes mouthwash, denture cleaners, all oral hygiene products. You'll see it classified as dentifrices in the report. And inflow and infiltration being that portion of phosphorus that comes from groundwater seepage into the sanitary sewer system.
Mr. Chair.
So.
One moment. Representative Junkie.
Just before opinion. You skip by, what's food yeah. soils?
Yep.
Sure.
Mr. Tomasek.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie. That's the phosphorus that's associated with washing dishes, with garbage disposal. So all the food products that go down the sink, essentially, from
As a, Mr. Chair, as a soil scientist, I get worried about that word soils there. It's very confusing. And,
right.
And, you know, we're sensitive to the agriculture and the discussions that are going to come later on that. And I'd like to see that name something else. Garbage disposal waste would be a much better name to me than food.
You know, in the Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Yonke, I guess we classified it that because in the technical literature, that was the title that was given it, and it's really an inclusive bracketing of you know, the food that's washed off your dinner plate, that's washed off in a dishwashing when your plate is dirty, and garbage disposals are really a large portion of that. So I think there is a good caution with presenting that so people understand what that really means. Thank you. Considering the non-ingested portion we removed the human waste, the non-ingested portion is 50% of the total loading to POTWs. The goal, if you'll recall, was to reduce that by 50%, so that's a 28% reduction in phosphorus loading to POTWs overall to reach that 50% goal. We looked at the three categories highlighted in the lighter type. If one were to consider reducing both commercial and home dishwashing phosphorus completely, that's a 10% reduction. And an aggressive approach of possibly reducing industrial process wastewater by half, that's maybe a 14% reduction. So those two, those three sources total 24%, still short of the 28% reduction necessary to get to the 50%. And we generally feel that that's a fairly aggressive approach and would need to engage in conversation with industrial treatment plants, industrial produces the phosphorus and talk to them what's feasible and how can you change your operation or reduce your phosphorus going to POTWs. We can talk about it more later, but our approach is more to look at effluent limits and attach a 1 milligram per liter effluent limit to treatment plants as they are new or expanding. Because what we're really interested in is the phosphorus loadings to surface waters. And then let the wastewater treatment plants consider what is the best way for them to meet that limit. Can they get some of it from pre-treatment, from inflow reduction? Or is it really better for them simply to accept the phosphorus and remove phosphorus as they can in bio treatment of phosphorus in their wastewater treatment plant? So we would let them work their individual situation to their advantage for phosphorus reductions.
Mr. Tomasek?
Yes.
Are on the NPDES permits that are being issued now, are those, I think it's 0.3 milligrams per liter into a stream and 0.10 into a lake, I think that's right. Are those being incorporated now? Is that present rule, or is that a suggestion, or how does that play out for a community that's upgrading? Has an established plant that's upgrading and working into the NPDES permit at the same time.
Mr. Chairman, Marvin Hora, the limits that we're placing in NPDES permits right now are 1 milligram per liter, where it's a direct discharge to a lake or to a stream or river that directly affects the lake. At the present time, if a point source discharges to a river that does not affect or is not directly to a lake, there is no phosphorus limitation on those. What we have been doing is that when new facilities that are, or expanded facilities, which is the most reasonable time to come in and put that technology in, the most cost-effective time, when they discharge to a river system, they are also getting the 1 milligram per liter. We have very few locations in the state of Minnesota. I believe Lake Vermilion, I believe Bemidji, both have 0.3. Those are where there are very sensitive water bodies that we have shown that this level, expanded level, below the 1 milligram per liter is needed for protection.
Okay, thank you. But I guess the last, that's in rule presently, or is that something that's being, how do you get to that
in rule? Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. In rule presently, we have 1 milligram per liter, but the rule also provides the ability where we have a demonstrated need or shown a need to go lower than 1 milligram per liter. We can go and impose limits at down to 0.3 or to lower levels.
All right, thank you.
Now, one thing I would add to that is in the study, the bar engineering looked at how treatment plants are operating and even looked outside of Minnesota and found that Portland, Oregon has a treatment plant because of a TMDL project that's achieving a 0.07 milligram per liter effluent limit. So it shows, I guess, some of the sensitivity of waters in areas and low levels, at least in that part, that are treated to.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I'm having trouble just because we all don't know sewage that well, or I don't know sewage that well, obviously. You know it a lot better than I do. But when you're talking about a point per liter, if you have a huge plant, that means you're getting a huge amount of phosphorus even at a low level. If you have a small plant, you're not getting very much just because of the flow. So have people looked at not just point something per liter, but at more like a bulk? You cannot put more than this many pounds of phosphorus into a water body?
Ms. Thomas here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bouguinius. Yes, when we look at effluent limit setting for phosphorus, we consider what is the concentration that's needed to maintain water quality and water quality standards. And as Mr. Hora mentioned, that's why Bemidji and Ely both have 0.3 milligrams per liter, because the loading, the mass, the amount of phosphorus going to those receiving waters was high enough, and those are very sensitive resources, that the concentration was moved down to 0.3 rather than the typical 1 milligram per liter limit. And I think as we move into TMDLs, we'll be looking more at what is someone's allocated load to a surface water that achieves those water quality standards, takes it off the TMDL list, and what is the concentration and mass loading that we need to achieve to meet that TMDL.
Members, we have about 10 minutes to finish this presentation, so I'm going to... Did you have another question, Representative Wagenius?
I do, but I'll hold it.
Thank you. Mr. Tomasek.
Okay. the results... The other way... Well, we're going to look at non-point sources now. So these are the sources that we looked at for three different flow conditions. We looked at a low flow or a dry condition. We looked at an average flow condition, and we looked at a high flow condition. The source categories you can see on the right. Urban runoff, ISCS, non-ag rural are those landscapes that we think of as more natural landscapes, forested and prairie, stream bank erosion, ag tile drainage we looked at only for the Minnesota River Basin, since that's the only place we had good tile density information, de-icing chemicals, and this feedlot portion is only the phosphorus that runs off of the feedlot itself. It doesn't include the phosphorus that's land applied and part of the field runoff, which is then in crop and pasture runoff. Atmospheric deposition is simply that rainfall and dust particles that fall onto surface waters throughout the state. So you can see the relative proportions here. Cropland, pasture, 33%, and atmospheric deposition. I'll go through a series of two other slides that look at average and wet flow, and you might look at how these relative proportions change for different conditions.
Pardon me, Mr. Johnson. Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to that previous slide,
atmospheric deposition you stated was just to the surface waters, yet can you tell us, again, I think we're just in the point of clarity and the people using this report, you know, cropland and pasture continue to get a bad name, yet how much did you break down how much of the cropland and pasture is atmospheric deposition? You know, people are going to, they look at this and they interpolate and say, well, yeah, there's the cropland and the fertilizer they're putting down, yet a lot of that, I suspect, is just atmospheric deposition, just like you're reporting 30% just to the surface water area. So how much of that is on the cropland and pasture area, and how much of that cropland pasture area is attributed to actual fertilizer runoff, which is what we're going to get hit on in the ag community? Did you look at that, and can you separate those for us? Because, again, when you look at the ag drainage, it's a very small percent, and that's probably more indicative of natural background phosphorus and any soluble fertilizer coming out through the ag drainage, and that's fairly minimal. And compared to the cropland pasture, you know, to put that in a separate category like that and not explain what the makeup is, I think, is a bit misleading for our ag community.
Mr. Tomasek.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Yonke, we didn't look at that proportioning of how much of the atmospheric deposition can be attributed to the cropland runoff. I think we have the numbers where we can do that, and we've actually looked at a second study with Bar Engineering, a little more detailed look at some of these things, and we've actually done that for urban runoff areas. So I think it'd be a fairly simple thing to do for cropland, and we can look at that.
And, Mr. Chair, you do understand our concerns. I mean, when I look at cropland pasture, people are going to say that's the phosphorus fertilizer farmers are putting down.
Right.
And that's not necessarily the whole story there.
Yep. But and the complexity we came into when we looked at the urban runoff is, does 100% of that atmospheric deposition come off of the ag land? Is some retained? So there's an assessment that needs to be made when we look at that.
Continue, Mr. Tomasek.
This is for an average flow condition. Again, non-point sources of phosphorus, two surface waters statewide. So looking at the whole state, on a relative basis, atmospheric deposition decreases. Cropland pasture on a relative basis remaining about the same. And stream bank erosion really becoming a larger portion of the overall loading. We move to a wet condition, we see that stream bank erosion is really heavily driven by flow conditions. And during these high flow conditions, the channels erode much more readily and create a lot more phosphorus contribution to surface waters. Cropland pasture, again, remaining about the same. Another way to look at the data, putting the point and non-point source together, is considering the relative proportions of each, and we've done that for a dry, average, and wet condition. You can see, not surprising, as you go from a dry to a wet condition, the relative proportions of point and non-point change quite a bit. What really happens is the point sources remain relatively constant, and the non-point sources increase nearly twofold from a dry to an average, and again from an average to a wet condition. The reduction that you see on this chart is the load reduction from the metro plant here in the metro area, going from 2.97 milligram per liter effluent concentration to 1 milligram per liter concentration. So a very large reduction from one single plant, but that plant treats half the wastewater of the state. So a very large plant, which gets at the question about mass loading. If we put all this together in one pie chart, a little bit different presentation here. This commercial industrial process wastewater is both the phosphorus going through a POTW, and that amount of phosphorus from commercial industrial treatment plants that treat their own waste. So there's industrial wastewater that goes through POTWs, and some of those plants operate their own treatment systems. So that's combined in this one part of the pie. Maybe the important point here for dishwashing detergent is, as far as the overall loading to the state, it makes up less than 3%. So, you know, our perspective is we're not sure it's worth much energy in trying to manage that source as the restriction. Again, the better way would be through effluent limitations to reduce what's going to surface water. Just a bit of information on the 10 basins in the state. If we look at agricultural runoff, we see the breakdown for the different basins in the state, and you can recognize differences between the northern and the northeastern and southerly basins. Atmospheric deposition, again, as was mentioned, what we're looking at is loadings to surface waters. And the reason the northern basins have so much phosphorus going to the surface waters is not that the deposition rate is greater, just that there's a lot more surface water up there to load phosphorus onto. A difference of the Rainy River Basin having 50% water, the Minnesota River Basin being about 12% water. So a big difference in the amount of surface water present. Stream bank erosion. Lower Mississippi Basin is the bluff lands in southeast Minnesota, so the steepness and of the terrain and soils in that area, maybe not surprising that would be the area that would show up. Human waste, some higher portions in metro areas and the like. Processed wastewater, this being from industrial facilities, commercial, industrial, and then all other wastes, which are those other categories that were listed. Just a reminder why phosphorus is important: overabundance of algae and the recreational and environmental consequences of that. Summary, what we were able to do in this study is quantify the sources of phosphorus to POTWs, look at point and non-point source loadings by basin and throughout the whole state. Really solidify this idea that weather affects phosphorus loadings, and especially from non-point sources. Consider relationships between the different source categories by basin. And we think the report provides a backdrop for policy discussions and management discussions on phosphorus for maybe the next 10 years, that it should have that long a shelf life. The report is contained in the executive summary, which I think you all have copies of. There's also a much longer compendium of the full report, and I get tired of carrying it around with me, so I didn't bring it with me, but there's an appendices, which are technical memorandums for each source category that's double the thickness of this, so I decided to leave that at home today.
Thank you, Mr. Tomasek, Mr. Hora, for your presentation.
This is on the web, and it's available on the CD if you want to take copies of the full report electronically.
Members, I suggest you keep this in your packet, because if you have further questions, as I do, during our discussion on impaired waters, it'll be very helpful as we're looking for the resource material to discuss that issue. Members, and thank you again for coming before us today with your presentation. Members, on Thursday we're going to receive budget presentations from the Science Museum and also the Minnesota Conservation Corps. Are there any other matters to come before us? Being none, we are adjourned. Thank you.